Another reason the transformations fail is they just give up too soon. This stuff can take a long time. And sometimes people get halfway up the mountain and then they go, we're never going to get to the top. And they just slide all the way back down. And it's really a shame because they spent a lot of time and energy and money trying to get halfway up the mountain, but they just run out of steam. And one of the ways to give yourself more energy along the way are those quick wins. Be able to demonstrate to your stakeholders that are funding you, demonstrate to the team, and demonstrate to the customer, look, we are making progress, we are improving, we are seeing results.
Helping you create loyal customers and loyal employees all through the power of simplicity. This is the Simple Brand Podcast, now heard around the world, including Silver Peak, Nevada. I'm your host, Matt Lyles, and this week, I'm talking with Howard Tiersky. Howard's a CEO and founder of From, a digital transformation agency that helps some of the world's largest brands navigate digital transformation and reinvent their customer journeys to earn the love of today's digital customers. He's named one of the top 10 digital transformation influencers by IDG Magazine and one of the top 100 customer success strategists by Success Coaching. Howard's the author of the Wall Street Journal bestseller, Winning Digital Customers, The Antidote to Irrelevance. Now, Howard and I discuss why customer behavior drives the majority of revenue and growth for brands today. We discuss why the most valuable companies are known for providing a great and seamless customer experience. We discuss Howard's five-step roadmap to help your brand thrive in a digital world. So here it is. Here's my interview with Howard Tiersky. Hi, Howard. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Matt. Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
I am glad to finally be able to get to talk to you and to talk about your book, Winning Digital Customers, The Antidote to Irrelevance. You and your company, you're on a mission to help brands stay relevant. So I'm curious, what do you think it is that drives irrelevance in brands?
There can be different things, but the biggest transformational change that we've seen over the last couple of decades is clearly the influence of digital on every aspect of the way that we, well, frankly, every aspect of the way that most of any business's customers live their lives. And that includes engaging in the various types of activities that are probably driving them to your business, whether you're an accounting firm or an airline or a retailer or a clothing manufacturer, whatever it might be, your customers' lives have been dramatically transformed by their adoption of all kinds of digital technologies and capabilities in every sphere of their life, from dating to religion to learning to obviously all the aspects of work. And so when you have a customer that is so dramatically transformed, well, it's pretty hard to remain relevant if you aren't transforming as a business in some substantial way as well, since after all, successful businesses are usually successful because they've molded themselves to the needs of their customers. I think that this area of not keeping up sufficiently in the digital realms is the greatest threat and the most holistic threat. You could look at any individual industry or sub-industry and say, oh, well, there's other factors too. Of course, sure. But broadly speaking, this is the mega trend of our times.
So there's always going to be other nuances, other things that brands need to look at, but it's sure. Like that digital transformation.
I mean, there's style, fashion, you know, obviously, yeah. If you make furniture and the style of your furniture looks like it's from the 1970s, that may very well not resonate with your customer, things like that. So that's not, digital's not the only thing, but it's the biggest, most transformational and most holistic force in our business world today.
So sounds like that's table stakes for any customer experience.
Well, I mean, think of yourself as a customer. If you engage with a brand and it doesn't have an elegant digital experience, what does that tell you?
Yep. It sends up a lot
and
of
And what stuff. Does it tell you about not only the digital experience, but perhaps other things about that brand? One of the, when people do brand tracking studies, there's three or four or five questions they often ask. Awareness, you know, aided and unaided recall. But one of the big questions is always, is this a brand for people like me? And of course, you expect that there's plenty of brands that are super successful. I mean, Lululemon is not a brand for people like me. I don't identify with that brand, you know. It doesn't connect with my lifestyle. My 20-year-old daughters Of course, they're all over Lululemon. And that's fine because Lululemon is probably not trying to target me. But when brands aren't delivering a digital experience that at least is in the vicinity of the expectations of their customers, it often leads, and we know this because we do a lot of customer research at my company, people to say, you know, yeah, that might be a great brand, but they just don't get me. I don't think that's a brand for me because I'm not able to engage with them and interact with them in the way that I'm comfortable with. Or I might be able to engage with them because they have Facebook Instant Messenger, or they have an app or a website, or but it's bad, or it doesn't meet my expectations as a customer. And what that says to me either is that this is a brand that doesn't get it, right? Which is pretty poisonous in terms of somebody of developing affinity and loyalty toward the brand. Or even worse, this is a brand that doesn't care. They could be better. They could be delivering a great digital experience. They just don't seem to want to bother. And that's even worse.
Yeah, it's like we'll go and try a new restaurant. And if we walk in the door and like the first thing you see is just trash or unclean tables, you think, well, wait a minute, they should know to take care of that. If they're not taking care of that, what are all the other things that they're not taking care of as well?
Yeah, what does it look like in the kitchen? If that's what the part that they know you're looking at looks like. Or in the digital realm, if this is my digital experience when I'm pondering a purchase, for example, what do I expect? You know, if I'm on the website of an airline trying to buy a ticket and it's a bad experience, what do I think the Wi-Fi on the flight's going to be like? Or forget the Wi-Fi, what do I think the experience of getting on and off the airplane is going to be like? And by the way, many of these perceptions, they may not be true. It may be that the company that doesn't have a great digital experience, it's not because they don't care. There might be another reason. Yeah, legacy tech stack, not enough budgets, internal infighting, politics. I mean, there's all kinds of reasons, right? And it could very well be that that airline that has a bad booking experience has fantastic Wi-Fi on their planes. It's totally possible. But the point is that to the consumer, and this is what we see in our research all the time, they make those suppositions. And that can be very negative in terms of the business goals that we typically have, which is what? To get our customers to buy more often, to tell their friends. You know, these universal business goals, we're pushing in the wrong direction when we create those negative perceptions, even if they're false.
And to the customer, their perception is their reality. It's their truth.
That's what they're going to use to make their decisions on. Yeah.
Well, in the book, you talk about earning love from customers as the single most important factor in a brand success. So what is true customer love?
Well, one of the things we know from extensive research is that having a strong emotional connection with your customer is very, very valuable in terms of their likelihood of repeat purchase, in terms of their likelihood of word of mouth, sharing with their friends, whether that's on social media or just one-on-one. And also in terms of things like their price sensitivity. You know, if you look at consumers who are, let's say, passionate about a brand like Apple or Disney or Harley Davidson, you know, you have lower marketing costs to reach these people because they want to know about your new product. They're coming to you to learn about your new product. They're less price sensitive. They're more likely to be loyal. If someone loves, let's say, Nikon cameras, and some people are lifelong brand advocates for Nikon, when Nikon comes out with their next generation camera, they're much less likely to shop around and say, oh, Sony might have something that's a little better, or a little higher resolution, because they're Nikon people. And so when you can get that kind of emotional commitment from your customer, which most brands don't have, by the way, but there are certainly many examples of brands that do, that is hugely and enormously valuable. Take Disney. When Disney launched Disney Plus, for example, their paid subscription service to compete with Netflix and Hulu, I believe, if I'm remembering the stats correctly, within 6 months of launch, they had as many paid customers as Hulu and half as many as Netflix, brands that have been in the market for well over a decade.
Yeah.
And that's the power of having a brand. By the way, Paramount, another movie studio, you know, launches their own app. You don't see nearly that kind of adoption. You have that kind of affinity for a brand like Disney, which can drive the growth of a new product in a totally new product category for Disney. That's the power of having that kind of fan base that's emotionally connected to you. And so we call that love. I call that customer love, bearing in mind, of course, that we use the word love in lots of different ways. As I say in the book, you know, I love my wife. And I love my Ford Mustang, but not in exactly the same way.
Yeah.
And when we talk about people loving the brand Starbucks, again, we don't mean the same way that you love your child, but that's the term that we use instead of, for example, the term loyalty, which some people say, well, isn't that what you mean? And kind of it is, but we find that to be kind of an overloaded term in business today. So often when we talk about loyalty, we think about things like loyalty programs. And really, loyalty programs are not really about, honestly, not really about loyalty. If you think of loyalty as an emotion, loyalty programs, you know, they're a kind of a discount program, right? They're a kind of a reward program, of course. If you buy this many airline tickets from me, I will give you a free ticket, right? You're improving the value proposition. If you come to my store and buy this much clothing and you come back another day, you can shop, you can get 10% off, whatever. Okay, that's fine. Nothing against it. It's a discounting program. It's a reward program. It's not really going to create an emotional connection. It may cause repeat purchases, and that's all well and good. But just so that we don't get confused between that idea, which is such a commonly used term in business when we talk about the idea of loyalty as a behavior, loyalty as simply meaning I'm a repeat customer. That's different from having an emotional connection. I am a repeat customer of British Petroleum because their service station is on a corner in my town that I frequently pass. And so they might look at me in their data analytics system, in their customer data mart, and say, this guy is a really loyal customer. Yeah. But if British Petroleum went away, would I give a damn? No, I would just go to the service station across the street. Whereas how would the people who are regular customers of Apple feel if Apple was gone tomorrow and they had to go to Dell, or people who go to Disney regularly? Oh, sorry, you're going to have to go to Six Flags on your next vacation and there's no more Disney cartoons. So you're going to have to watch something from somebody else. This is a completely different kind of emotional relationship. So we just have to be careful that we don't conflate these two things. They're both important. Repeat purchases are important. Emotional connection is important. But that's why we don't use the term loyalty.
And when you think of loyalty in that regards, whether it's just repeat purchases or like marketers like to talk about the loyalty marketing programs, to me, that's very transactional. Like you were saying with your BP gas station, if they were to close down, it wouldn't be that much of a loss. You just go to the next gas station.
I'd have to drive one block farther to get my gas.
One block.
And I would, and my life would be unchanged.
My boys, they're currently 13 and 10. They're into comics and toys. And there's a few different comic stores around town that they've, you know, gone to. Well, one of them just recently, a few months ago, decided to close. Well, they, I don't think they decided to close. I think their customers decided for them, but they were closing. And so I told the boys about it, thinking they might feel a little sad, but they're like, eh, okay, no big deal, because everything that we would have gotten there, we can get somewhere else. And honestly, when we were there, I don't think they really even cared that we were there. So they felt no loss for this store closing.
Well, the last thing you said I want to touch on in particular, which is that customer love is really a relationship. And while it's not the same as a love between two people, it has a lot of analogies. One of the things that makes me love somebody is if I feel like they love me, or maybe it starts with just like or affection, you know, I mean, it builds up, right? But one of the criteria that we have for starting to feel more warmly towards someone is we feel that some sense of reciprocity. So when you go to a business and you truly feel that they care about you, that's kind of rare, especially in today's world where so many businesses are, you know, the local drugstore. When I grew up, we had our local pharmacist who had his own drugstore. Of course, today that's all Walgreens and CVS. So it's a lot harder to get that feeling that the people at Walgreens care about you the way that we might have felt that the pharmacist at our local drugstore cared about us. But when you have a small business like a comic book shop, I agree with you. I think that if you can help your customers feel like you truly care, that's one component. And in the book, we talk about the formula for customer love, but that sense of they really care about me is profound. And by the way, there are many big companies that attempt to accomplish that by something like saying, thank you for your business on the bottom of every credit card statement or things like that. And these are, they're not harmful typically, but these are very hollow words. You know, people are smart. They see through that. They know that you printed that, or we appreciate you as a customer, all printed on every single invoice. So you're basically saying to every customer you appreciate them. Well, that's fine, but it doesn't make me feel special. It doesn't make me feel like you care about me. if you care about everybody. Some sense of being cared about as a differentiated individual. In Chicago, there's a Greek town where there's a lot of Greek restaurants.
Oh, yes.
And I remember as a kid being taken to a Greek restaurant in Greek town and sitting there, I was probably 7 or 8 years old. And the owner of the restaurant comes over to the table and he welcomes us and he welcomes my father as the, you know, man of the house. He shakes his hand. He says, I'm going to send over a special appetizer for your table. I thought that my father must be someone very important because clearly, at least at this restaurant, he was being greeted like family. Only did I realize over the years of observing this restaurant that that's how they greeted everybody. The owner came over, he shook your hand, he thanked you, and you really felt that this guy was really happy to see you, you personally. And that's tough. That's a tough thing to replicate, particularly at scale. But when you can do it, it really does drive what we might conventionally call loyalty and that emotional connection. So that when there's another Greek restaurant down the street, you're like, but those guys, they counted us. They so look forward to me coming to their restaurant. How could I let them down?
I mean, I don't want to let them down. And also, I don't want to have to test out whether somebody else is going to make me feel that valued or not when I know that I'm already valued over here.
And God forbid the owner of the other restaurant should see me walking out of the new Greek restaurant. You know,
yeah.
I would feel so horrible, right? And again, I mean, that's part of love too, right? A sense of commitment, a sense of wanting to demonstrate a certain fidelity. Not that a restaurant expects you to never go to another restaurant, but this is emotion, right? This is when you're feeling something. It's not all transactional. When brands can evoke that sense of feeling, that's super powerful.
We've talked about this at a small business brick and mortar type level here. And it seems like it's really easy to do when you actually have like a real human being interacting with another human being customer in your store. But when we take it up to the larger level and take up to that digital transformation level, it sounds like a number of brands are trying to create these things in their digital transformation. But one of the bits of research from your book, I think, that really stood out to me was 84% of digital transformations fail. So what do you think causes them to fail?
You know, it's almost always the people. It's almost never the technology.
Really? Okay. How's that?
Indeed. Well, there's a number of factors, but I think the biggest cause of the failure of digital transformation, of course, failure can mean a lot of different things, right? You have goals, you don't achieve your goals.
Yeah.
You know, that can be defined as a failure. You may still have made some progress. But, you know, transformation is just sort of a fancy word for change. We're going to make a big change, right? One reason transformations fail is you don't make the right changes. The people who are driving the change, maybe, for example, they have a vision. This is what our new customer experience should be. And they feel a lot of ownership over that vision. They have a commitment. It's almost like a child that you want to see grow up and be successful. I've envisioned it and I'm going to make it happen. That's great, but is that the experience that your customers actually want? Because we have to be careful. We can change. Doesn't necessarily mean we're getting better. It doesn't necessarily mean we're creating more value for our customers. You know, of all the ways you could change, only a very small percentage of them are actually going to have a positive impact on your customer and on your business. You could hit every customer over the head with a hammer when they walk into your store and that would be changed, right? Now, obviously, no one's going to do that. But it's not that uncommon that a company might come out with a new product or some new process or some new digital capability and customers feel like they've been hit over the head with a hammer. Why are you doing this to me? Why have you changed this thing? So that's one challenge. That's one people problem, which is that we haven't really, and this is why the approach that I describe in the book, our 5-step approach to digital transformation, is rooted in customer research. That's, of course, not the only aspect to it, but making sure we have the insight to understand what does the customer really need and how can we create a truly better experience through transformation? Because if you do a digital transformation and you haven't increased the value for the customer, it's unlikely that you're going to increase the value for your enterprise. Because the best way to increase the value you receive from the customer, because that's where all the value comes from, generally speaking. I mean, once in a while you have, you know, startups that all their value just comes from investors who believe there would be some future payout. But in a normal business, the value comes from the customer in exchange for value that they've received. I mean, just basic business. So you should be thinking about how am I going to create more value for the customer? And then I can charge more, or then the customer will buy more, et cetera, et cetera. Lower my cost to acquire or reduce the likelihood that that customer will spend waste a lot of money returning the product or calling my call center for hours at end, or all the things that customers can do to either make or break our business. And so I think that getting that right, it requires research and requires a certain discipline, because sometimes it means being willing to step away from our assumptions and being willing to not pursue what just feels like the right path, but make sure that there's a combination of art and science. So that's one. And there's many, but I'll give you one more, which is internal resistance to change. You might create a vision. Let's say you do have the right vision. You haven't fallen into the first pitfall I mentioned. You have a vision that will really, really resonate with your customers. And you have a good kind of scientific basis to believe that if you make these changes, you'll really improve the business. You'll improve the value to the customer. That's great. Now you need an organization to get behind it, though. Rarely can you implement something without support from IT, marketing, sales, product development, finance, legal, human resources, because you have to recruit all the people you need. You're going to change your processes if you're really talking transformation. Are all these people behind this transformation? Well, hopefully, but more often than not, no. Or certainly it's not automatic. There's a lot you have to get right to actually have an organization truly be behind transformation, because I find that for most people, maybe let's say unscientifically 85% of people in the world, they don't particularly like change. They like to kind of get things a certain way. It's how I do my job or whatever. And you know what? Please don't mess with it. I've learned how to do this. You know, don't give me a new system. I know you say it's better, but I've already learned the old one. When those new elevators came out where instead of pushing up and down, you put typed in the floor number of your floor. Have you experienced these elevators?
No.
Oh, well, a lot of buildings have been installing these new type of elevators where instead of pushing up and then waiting for an elevator.
Yeah.
Let's say you're going to 23rd floor. You type in, it's a keypad. There's no up and down button. You type in 23.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Have you seen these? And then it tells you.
I have seen that.
You're assigned elevator B or whatever. And then you stand in front of elevator B and wait for it to come. Other elevators might show up first, but those aren't your elevator. And then you get in and there's no buttons inside. You can only go to the floor that you've been pre-programmed to go to, right? And the vision behind this product is it makes the elevators faster because they're optimizing the elevators to make sure that not every elevator is stopping at every floor. It makes sense. And people do want faster elevators. But people find this to be a big pain in the butt. It takes something that most people have mastered, truly mastered, which is how to use an elevator.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, they're idiots. They're like looking, going, how do I operate this thing? And then they get in and they can't change their mind. So point being that there's a natural human resistance to change for most people, small percentage of people. And by the way, I wouldn't be surprised if you and I are both in the 15%, because people who wind up in jobs driving transformation and innovation at companies, they're very often the people who love change. They signed up to do it for a living.
Oh, yeah.
And sometimes they make the mistake, and we all make this mistake. It's natural thinking, well, everybody's like me. I mean, the way I am, if you've ever taken a Myers-Briggs test, I'm ENTP.
Oh, well.
That's, of course, the best one, right?
Well.
That's how it feels to me.
I'm an ENFP.
Yeah. Oh, so we're similar.
Similar,
so, but you know, so congratulations on not being one of those bad ones. You know, of course, what you learn in my biggest, there's no bad ones. They're all valuable, but there's a natural kind of egocentric way of looking at the world where you tend to see yourself as being the right way. So people who are trying to drive transformation can sometimes make the mistake of saying, I just got to tell everybody how great this is going to be. And they're all going to think it's great. And a lot of them are going to think, that sounds like a big pain in the butt. And it's not necessarily because they don't believe that the elevators will be faster. It doesn't necessarily mean it's that they don't believe the business will be improved. But their first thought is of themselves, not of improving the business. And for them, it sounds like a hassle. And so when people are not on board, what happens then? They don't show up to meetings. They give you overinflated estimates and budgets. They drag their feet. They don't approve things. They talk badly behind your back. They come up with reasons. And then what happens when you have a problem? You know, when you're driving a transformation, inevitably you're going to hit all kinds of problems and potholes, because that's how it is when you're making major changes. And if people are against you, and somebody's always going to be against you, as soon as you hit those problems, you're going to say, see, this isn't going to work out. I said this transformation was a bad idea from the beginning. Look, they have a problem. Look, they're over budget. look, the first version of the app doesn't work right. Look, some customers don't like it. Look, the pricing was wrong. We just sold 300 seats on an airplane for half of what we meant to because of a computer glitch. We got to stop this. We got to put this thing out of its misery, right? That's a classic strategy for somebody who's essentially trying to resist change. And there's a lot of it. And that's one of the other biggest challenges and reasons why you'd ask me why transformations fail. That's one of the biggest reasons. You just can't get everybody rowing in the same direction.
Thankfully, I was able to learn this maybe halfway through my career because I you're right. I'm in that first quartile of people that like and embrace change. And I was taught that the population of people, you can look at them like they're all on the face of a clock. And somewhere in that first 5 minutes, there's a small, tiny percent of people that love to drive change just for the sake of change. Doesn't matter what it is. I just want to change. And tomorrow I'm going to change it again, probably. There's people like, I believe yourself and myself, who are in that first 15 minutes that are very flexible, very adaptable to driving change. And then there's other people in all the different quartiles that just need a little bit of handholding, need some help in moving forward with that change. And so I think the best leaders that drive change and that drive transformation understand that fact and try to understand where everybody falls and understand who do they need to reach out to, whose hand do they need to hold, who do they need to give some more time and resources to help bring them over.
Right. And to be perfectly blunt, who are they probably never going to win over? And do they need to deal with appropriately and watch their back? Because transformation is often a game of keeping an eye out for sabotage. Because you're absolutely right. You want to do everything you can to bring as many people along with you. And you're naive if you think you're going to be successful at bringing everyone along with you. The honest truth is, it's like all these conversations we have about ChatGPT now. Obviously, one of the most transformational technologies I've seen in my lifetime, maybe the most. The question of comes up, is this going to cost people their jobs? And you hear all these people trying to hem and haw, oh, well, it's going to create jobs. It's like, that's fine. That's not the question, though. I mean, that's a question. But is this going to cost people their jobs? Hell yes. There's going to be huge numbers of people who are no longer needed because AI of one form or another can essentially do a huge portion of what they did before. Or if it can only do 60% of their jobs, great. That means we only need 40% as many people in that role because those people are going to use AI to be two and a half times as productive. But for sure, it's going to cost jobs. Now, yes, it'll create jobs for sure. But if you're the person whose job is being taken, that doesn't mean you have the skills to do the job that's been created. So for you as an individual, this is potentially a bad thing. And there's almost no denying it. Is this going to affect your ability to put money aside for your kids' college tuition? Yes. So we have to be a little bit, you know, clear-eyed about that. And sometimes I like to use the example of a rowboat. You know, if you're trying to drive transformation, it's like you're trying to row the rowboat. You're already trying to row upstream because the company already has a natural way of doing things. Right. And if you're trying to row that boat upstream by yourself, you're probably not going to be successful. It's just too much for one person. So you try to get some other people in the boat. You say, let me tell you about this great thing. So what happens then? Well, first of all, there's some people who say, hell no. And they start rowing in the other direction. So now it's even worse. Now not only are you rowing upstream, but you've got people literally, you're rowing in the other direction. And then maybe you find some other people who say, you know what? I agree with you about the change, but I don't think the change should be exactly the change you're describing. I think it should be a little different. I think maybe the change, instead of going this way, should kind of go a little bit to the left of there. And some people say, well, I agree also about change, but I think it should be a little to the right of there. And now you've got these other people who are rowing, but they're also not quite rowing in the direction you're trying to row. This is driving transformation. And again, the more people you can get rowing the direction you want to go, or at least approximately, the more forward motion you're going to make. And if you can't get the people who are rowing against you to stop it, you got to get them out of the boat. Otherwise, it's just very, very difficult to accomplish your goals. And that's one, these things fail because it's tough. It can be like almost a war at some organizations to really transform them when they've been operating the same way for a long time.
And then, like you said, you've just got to be able to get everybody moving in the same direction. And that's going to make it a lot easier. And it's going to make that change a lot easier and happen more quickly, too.
Yeah.
We talked about the things that can make a digital transformation fail. But when it comes to actually succeeding and making digital transformation succeed, in your customer experience, you've got the five-step roadmap for transforming customer experience. Can you walk me through those?
Sure. The first step is to understand the customer, because as we talked about earlier, that's how you're aiming. You're going to put this firepower behind transformation, but is it actually going to deliver value? You have to understand, what is the customer trying to accomplish when they engage with a business such as yours? And what are the points of pain that they have today? Because those create opportunities to create more value. Uber came along and had an insight, which is that there's a better way to provide ground transportation. Allow someone to call the car, not, it depends on where you are, but if you live like in the New York City area like me, you have to stand on the curb with your arm out, looking down the road, waiting for a taxi to come, versus being able to push a button and have it come right to you and know when it's going to be there, even if it's going to take 15 minutes, better than standing on the street for 15 minutes. It's all the benefits of not having to communicate with the driver about where you're going. They already know. They take you via GPS. All the things that make ride-sharing apps a much smoother experience than most historical forms of ground transportation. But it's that insight of what's going to matter to the customer that is the foundation, in my experience, of all successful transformation. Then the second thing is to map the future, to understand, okay, well, you know, we understand where what this current experience is, but what's the solution, right? We can understand what the points of pain and the problems are, but what's the future solution that we're trying to get to? And we do a lot of journey mapping, for example. So the first step is usually a lot of customer research, can be ethnography, surveys, interviews, things like that, data analysis, social listening. There's a whole, and I talk about all these different techniques in my book, different methods of understanding the customer. And then the process of mapping out what the current experience is and what would that future experience be. If you were going to start this whole company from scratch and you said, I want to build this for 2023 or even better for 2025, what's the experience I would want to give the customer? And map that out. So that's the second step. Now, once you've got that, you want to go to the third step, which is to build the change, right? You've now envisioned a future, and it probably involves apps and websites and chatbots and back-end components that might be ways of dealing with customer data and personalization, or obviously it's going to depend on the individual business. Now you have to build it. And so in the book, we talk a lot about design thinking practices and agile practices on how you actually take that higher level journey vision and break it into components and successfully build it over time on a roadmap. So those make the kind of three, you know, as you mentioned, there's five steps, but these three are sort of the core and they're somewhat serial. You can do some of that in parallel, but really you need to first understand the customer. Right. And then you need to map the journey, and then you're breaking that journey down into pieces and building it. The other two components run parallel to those two. One is to optimize the present, because even while you're coming up with these bold, ambitious visions of a transformed experience, the experience that will really enable you to compete toe-to-toe with anyone in the marketplace and have your customers feeling like you really represent the level of digital elegance they expect, While you're on the what may very well be multi-year journey to that, there's probably some stuff you can fix right now. Things that are creating confusion, frustration, annoyance for your customers, and making sure that you're identifying those and every quarter fixing more of those things, which may not get you to that transformation, that may not get you to customer love, but at least it gives something, both in terms of customer improvement and in terms of business improvement, while you're on that longer transformation journey. Because another reason the transformations fail is they just give up too soon. This stuff can take a long time. And sometimes people get halfway up the mountain and then they go, we're never going to get to the top. And they just slide all the way back down. And it's really a shame because they spent a lot of time and energy and money trying to get halfway up the mountain, but they just run out of steam. And one of the ways to give yourself more energy along the way are those quick wins. Be able to demonstrate to your stakeholders that are funding you, demonstrate to the team and demonstrate to the customer, look, we are making progress. We are improving. We are seeing results. So that's to optimize the present. And then the last of the five steps is the other one that kind of runs the whole duration. And it's the one we've been talking about, which is to lead the change. Recognize that people aren't just going to fall in line. You need a strong, persuasive approach. In the book, we talk a lot about storytelling and how to be persuasive and get different constituents within your organization to want to row in the same direction and how to deal with those that you're not going to be able to win over. That element of leadership is probably the hardest part of digital transformation. And it's much harder to lead an organization through a transformation than to lead an organization that's operating in a kind of a steady state way, maybe just making incremental improvements, et cetera. So it's a real art form. And we try to provide some guidance on some of the methods that I've seen work at some of the many, many large brands that I've worked with over the years in the book.
When it comes to leading that change and having more people buy into it, especially some of the, maybe not the hardcore detractors, but some of those people that are fence riders, people that are middle of the road, is like, I really don't know. It sounds like one of the ways to help them is what you talk about in optimizing for the present, optimizing for the short term with those quick wins that can help people start to see some of the results. How do you know which quick wins to take? How do you know the ones that are going to give you the most value, the most return in the short term?
In the book, we provide a prioritization process. There's a methodology for evaluating and analyzing where the opportunities are. Of course, sometimes when you first identify a need, let's say a point of pain in the current purchase process, it's not always immediately apparent whether it's a quick win or not, because you have to figure out what would I like to change it to and what's the level of effort. And sometimes that requires pulling in people from your technology team, for example, or others to understand, well, what's the implications of making this change? And you may discover that something that seems simple, for whatever reason, is actually a huge lift from a technology perspective. And sometimes things that seem like they'd be difficult, someone can say, well, no, actually, we can connect to a third-party cloud-based platform and we can enable that really quickly. So you want to be careful that you don't draw conclusions too fast. And by the way, this dovetails nicely with transformation work, because as part of transformation work, you're doing the same thing. You're trying to figure out, what are the changes we need to make in order to create a great experience? And as you're going through identifying those things, you're going to probably discover that some of them are quick wins. And some of them, it's like, in order to provide the level of personalization we want, we've got to rip out half of our technology stack. We need a whole new approach to data. You know, that's not something we're going to do next month. It's just not possible. And in other cases, you can find quick ways. So I think that's probably the trick of it. And we provide a lot of like tips and suggestions in the book on how to go about that. In the end, though, it's like prioritizing anything. Impact and effort. You need to be able to figure out both of those things. And in the book, I'm happy to answer. I mean, I'm not trying to hold back here.
Oh, so, of course.
To get the answer to that question. But obviously, there's only so much time on a podcast. But because there's a lot of rigor in the book. And actually, there's some supplemental material that's on the password protected site that you get access to with the book that further provides more tools or a spreadsheet with formulas.
Yeah.
That's designed to help you identify lots of initiatives and prioritize them on a number of different dimensions. For example, when you're looking at prioritizing the impact, let's say you find a flaw in your checkout process that's hurting customers and creating frustration and maybe loss of revenue. Well, you know, you want to understand, first of all, how many people does this problem impact? If it's in your sales calculations for the state of Maryland, obviously it's not impacting everybody. No, it's impacting some percentage. What percentage is that? Depends on your business. Maybe that's 2/3 of your business in Maryland. I don't know. Or maybe that's, you know, 5% or whatever. I mean, it depends, right? And then the second question is, how bad is the impact? Is this just a minor thing that most people will just get past? Or is this for the people who are impacted by it? It has a huge negative impact. There's no way they're going to buy from you if they experience this flaw. They're never going to come back. It's like a customer death. And there's a few other factors too, like, does this disproportionately affect your best customers? Sometimes it happens that our best customers have the most sophisticated needs. They're buying all of our different products, and they're dealing with all of our different communications channels. They see seams and problems in the experience that maybe a customer who's very transactional and only buys one thing one time would not notice. But unfortunately, if you allow those kinds of seams and problems to exist, if they're impacting your most valuable customers, then that makes them maybe even worse than if they were impacting the same number of people, but they were your more just one-time transactional customers. So that's just a taste of what we get into to try to say, fine, so we can look at each of these different categories. And it's probably not going to be perfectly precise, but this helps you break it down and say, these are the different considerations. And then let's create a matrix that sort of scores these, weights them, multiplies them together, and then gives us a method to be able to say, okay, so if we were to sort this in a spreadsheet, which things come to the top? And you're not necessarily going to make that as your ultimate decision criteria. You're going to use other factors and human knowledge and intuition, I think. But at least it gives you a way of taking a large number of issues and quickly seeing which ones seem the worthy of the most, you know, close investigation.
And those tools help simplify that process for you, help simplify your thinking to help you decide how you want to prioritize.
Yeah, breaking things down into the discrete components sometimes can feel more complicated, you know? Like, it's like, no, instead of just deciding what the value is, we're going to look at five different aspects of the value. In some ways, it's adding complexity. But what you're really trying to do is take something that really was already complex. And if you just take a sort of swing at it, the risk is you may not be right, because you really kind of need to look at these different things. It improves your accuracy. And I always find breaking things down into their component parts, just like our five steps to digital transformation, it makes it more actionable, even if it seems like it adds complexity, because now you have a series of steps to follow instead of just taking a swing at things, which very often doesn't yield. That's why you have such a high failure rate of digital transformations.
And it also helps give you a roadmap, basically, to understand where you are in the process. Oh, we've done this step, now we're on this step, and we know that these are the next steps to go on, instead of just being somewhat blind to it and having that confusion or paralysis that comes from not knowing really what you're going to do next and when things are going to actually end.
Yeah, you're right. And the point that you were making earlier about needing the quick wins to keep people along, a roadmap helps too, because let's say you start a digital transformation and you're 4 months in. And after 4 months, you've done a bunch of customer research and you've created a bunch of journey maps. So let's say you spent a bunch of money doing that, you know, still go to combine, say 4 months in, what have you built? What's changed? What's been improved? Maybe nothing, or maybe just a few of those quick wins. That's like, well, that's not very good progress for 4 months. Well, you know, there's a process we're following. And then at least you can look at the roadmap and say, no, we're this far along the roadmap. It's not a situation where, you know, if it's a 2-year transformation, you're necessarily going to get 25% of the functionality online in the first half of the first of the 2 years. But you need to set that expectation out up front. Otherwise, people go, you're 6 months in, you haven't built anything. Well, okay, that's true. But imagine you wanted to build a new house and you bought this new piece of property and you just get a bunch of lumber and start hammering. You're probably not going to get very far. Or you get some concrete and start pouring it on the grass and then start to get some lumber. I mean, this is not a way to build a house, right? So the reality is you could be 6 months into building your new house and you could not have even laid the foundation, but you've still made tremendous progress. That's the right way to follow the process. I always say there's no one right way to do anything, in my belief, but there's certainly a lot of wrong ways. Sometimes the desire for speed and transformation drives folks to want to demonstrate quick progress. And again, that's fine as long as it's in that quick hits lane, because there is a lane for that. But for the broader transformation, having that roadmap that you can at least say, look, we have accomplished things. You might not be seeing them in our app yet. That we've done this research, we've done this journey mapping, we have this vision, we have created estimates, we have technical architecture done. It's really important that people see that that's a part of a planned journey and not just an excuse for not getting more stuff done faster.
That's a big part of that leading the change process, is helping to set the expectations with everyone
Critical.
Else. Here's the roadmap, here's the timeline, and here's what it's going to look at each step along the way. And here's where we are today, and here's where we're going to be tomorrow.
Yes. Another thing about setting those expectations is to set the expectation that this is a challenging, somewhat risky process. Yeah. And we will probably have unanticipated setbacks along the way. Very often when we're trying to sell something, we're trying to get the funding, we're trying to get the buy-in, that doesn't sound like a wise thing to say.
Yeah.
That's not a very strong sales pitch. But the problem with a lot of transformations is that they lose funding partway through. Someone says, okay, fine, we'll give you $10 million. And $1.5 million in, they cut your budget and you can never finish anything. And then the $1.5 million is wasted. So you have to remember, you're not just selling for today, but just as you said, where you're setting expectations for the future. And if you give them too rosy of an expectation, whoever it is that's with your board of directors or your C-suite or whoever is making these decisions, and then you don't meet those expectations, it's perfectly reasonable for them to think, oh my gosh, I've given them $1 million and they're already behind budget. At $10 million, how behind budget are we going to be, or whatever? You know, to get nervous and worried, because making investments is risky. Making large investments is risky. CEOs are often judged on the success of these things. Shareholders look to the profitability of a company. And when you choose to make investments, you're taking money out of your EBITDA, out of your profit of the company. That can affect your share price. So you have to keep people's confidence high, all the way through, at least in the case of a public company, to your investors. And again, when there's bumps in the road, that can be a major disruption to their confidence, which can be a major risk to the project. So inoculating yourself somewhat. And as I mentioned earlier, your enemies will jump on these things. Especially if you've not set expectations. So I love that you brought that up. You inoculate yourself to some degree. You can remind everyone later, hey guys, remember how I told you 6 months ago there'd be some bumps along the road? Well, good news, we hit one. Let me tell you about it. It's totally expected. We might not have known what the bump was going to be, because if we knew about it, we would have found a way to avoid it. And by the way, another thing that's in the book is there's a model there. I think it's the 9 biggest risks to transformation.
Yeah.
And there's financial risks and technical risks and legal risks and human risks and customer adoption risks. It talks about how you can identify them in advance, or at least do a better job, because to the degree that you see the risks, you're much more likely to be able to avoid them. Rarely do we wind up with a flat tire as a result of hitting a pothole that we knew a mile in advance was there, right? I mean, usually not, right? If you know the pothole's there, you steer around it. It's the pothole that you failed to anticipate that causes you to, like I had happen to me last year, not only get a flat tire, but dent the rim. So I have to have the whole rhythm replaced, you know? There's a lot of stuff in the book about how can you look ahead and anticipate these problems and what are the common problems, so at least you have a greater chance of not hitting them. But again, you're still going to hit problems that you don't anticipate because you can't anticipate everything. And inoculating yourself by setting expectations is a great idea.
That's one of the things that I really love about your book, is not just that it's a great framework for crafting and creating and delivering a great digital customer experience, but it also goes really in depth on exactly how you can lead this through your company, recognizing that there's that need for setting expectations, recognizing the need for helping bring others to rowing in the same direction as you, and all those things. I've learned a lot from the book. I've learned a lot from talking with you today, but where can people go to learn more?
Well, if you're interested in the book, again, the title of the book is Winning Digital Customers, The Antidote to Irrelevance. And you can get it from Amazon or Apple Books or pretty much anywhere you get books. But there's also a website for the book. So if you want to check that out, you can go to winningdigitalcustomers.com, like obviously no spaces, all one word. And in fact, if you go there, you can download the first chapter of the book for free, as well as see various testimonials, a nice video of Kevin O'Leary talking about why he liked the book and stuff like that. You can also find me on LinkedIn. Feel free to connect with me or follow me. I publish a lot of content on LinkedIn almost every day. Various articles. I have a newsletter on LinkedIn, video, stuff like that. So you can just find me under my name, Howard Tiersky. And if you're interested in consulting services, what my company does professionally, helping companies through this process of transformation, you can find my company's name is From, the Digital Transformation Agency, and we are online at from.digital.
Thank you for sharing that. And thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a lot of fun. Great questions.
I hope you enjoyed my discussion with Howard Tiersky. You can go and learn more from him at winningdigitalcustomers.com. Go and follow him on LinkedIn, where he regularly posts content and articles, all to help you learn how to drive digital transformation and how to create the digital experience that customers demand today. And if you're enjoying the Simple Brand podcast, go ahead and hit the subscribe button, because it's going to make it so much simpler for you to get future episodes like the next one, featuring someone that I've actually known for over a decade in my career, Alan Adamson. We'll be talking all about lessons from Alan's latest book, Seeing the How: Transforming What People Do, Not Buy, to Gain Market Advantage. So go ahead and subscribe. You'll automatically get Alan's episode as soon as it's live. Until then, keep it simple.